This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Today we hear a reaction from victims of the former sports doctor Larry Nassar after his sentencing.
I am incredibly grateful for where we are, for everyone that spoke up, for everyone that fought to get us to this point. It just fills me with incredible gratitude.
Governor Snyder packed a lot into his State of the State address last night.
What we're hearing here is the governor saying that, look, I'm only here for a few more months, and this is all stuff that's got to be wrapped up before I walk out the door.
Then, is Michigan's school choice program working?
If I look at the original policy intent of legislation for school choice, it hasn't achieved those outcomes.
And we'll hear about a powerful but little-known U.S. senator from Grand Rapids.
He really viewed compromise not as something bad, but almost as an art form, as the way our democracy is supposed to work.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Coming up later this hour...
Folks, we're back, and we're only going to keep going up.
We'll talk with the It's Just Politics crew about the governor's State of the State message. But first, this afternoon, in an Ingham County courtroom, Judge Rosemary Aquilina sentenced the Michigan State University sports doctor who, for years, sexually assaulted girls and women athletes and called it medical treatment.
Sir, I'm giving you 175 years, which is 2,100 months. I just signed your death warrant.
The judge went on to say she normally believes in redemption, but not this time.
I find that you don't get it, that you're a danger. You remain a danger. I am a judge who believes in life and rehabilitation when rehabilitation is possible. I have many defendants come back here and show me the great things they've done in their lives after probation, after parole. I don't find that's possible with you.
Kate Wells has been in the courtroom day after day as 156 women and girls made victim impact statements, directing anger at their former doctor. Kate, what was the reaction in the courtroom after the sentence?
Applause, sustained standing applause for a solid minute. Everyone was embracing, from the prosecutors to the detectives that have led this case to the chief of MSU police. I think there's also just a sense of shock. I think this is pretty surreal for people. You know, they have been fighting this, some of them, for 20 years and have not been believed. You know, some of them, their entire childhoods were shaped by this, and suddenly here they are being heard. And now they have been able to confront the man who abused them, and he is going to die in prison.
Nassar made a statement to the court and to his victims. Here's a little bit of what he said.
Your words these past several days, your words, have had a significant emotional effect on myself and has shaken me to my core. I also recognize that what I am feeling pales in comparison to the pain, trauma, and emotional destruction that all of you are feeling.
So, did that have any impact on the survivors?
In the moment, it did, because previously, when Nassar has made statements, he's never really fully apologized like this. You can't quite hear it, but there were women that just started sobbing as he was speaking there. But the judge was not buying it. She, afterwards, when Nassar was done apologizing, said, look, I want to read from this 6-page letter that you wrote me before this all started. And in it, he denies any and all culpability. He says this was just medical treatments, that he only pled guilty because he wanted to avoid a trial for the sake of his community and his family. He said he even used the term, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And you could hear gasps throughout the entire crowd. So Aquilina told Nassar, look, I can't believe your apology, because here, when you write this 6-page letter essentially denying that you've done anything, it's clear to me that you don't actually believe that yourself.
Yeah, she read the whole thing, which was surprising. And I'm just wondering, did that reveal anything to any of the survivors?
I think it definitely changed the tone of Nassar's apology. I talked with them afterwards, and they said, you know, in the moment I felt like he was apologizing, and now that I know what he actually thinks, you know, obviously he does not understand what he's done.
One of the survivors, Kyle Stevens, reacted to that letter. What did she say?
She said that, first of all, she said the most important thing is her monster, as she put it, is gone. And then she said that in the moment when Nasser was apologizing, she started to believe it. And then afterwards, she realized that he had not been sincere.
At the time, I was like, I was just thoughtful. But then after hearing parts of his letter, it's just like, he's not sorry. I don't know what's going on in his head, but he clearly doesn't understand the impact of his actions.
It seems certain that this is not the end of Nasser's time in a courtroom or the end of fallout because of the institutions that failed these children. Where are the survivors taking their fight next?
Very much to those institutions. And really, that has been part of their fight from the beginning. It has been something that the vast majority of them have mentioned during their time in this courtroom telling their stories. They say, look, we do not have to be here. If adults at Michigan State University, if adults at USAG had been doing their jobs to protect us, to believe us when we bring these reports forward, this didn't have to happen. Rachel Denhollander says this entire case is an example of what happens when adults fail children.
Moving forward as a society, this is what it looks like. When the adults in authority do not respond properly to disclosures of sexual assault, this is what it looks like. When institutions create a culture where a predator can flourish unafraid and unabated. And this is what it looks like when people in authority refuse to listen, put friendships in front of the truth, fail to create or enforce proper policy, and fail to hold enablers accountable. This is what it looks like.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, she was incredible. I mean, this started with Rachel Denhollander in 2016. You know, we know the Me Too movement now, but when Rachel came forward, she was one person going up against a renowned, beloved Olympic doctor, and she went through a lot. People didn't believe her. People said that she was doing this for the money and the attention. And slowly but surely, over the last year and a half, 150 other women and girls have come forward and joined her.
That is Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Thanks very much, Kate.
Thank you, Lester.
Let's turn now to David Jesse with the Free Press. He joins us via Skype. He wrote an article yesterday headlined, "Most Michigan State Trustees Quiet During Calls for Simon's Resignation. Faculty Weighs In." David, the MSU faculty are now talking about a vote of no confidence in President Luana Simon. You've been negotiating this, and frankly, I'm a little confused because it involves the Faculty Senate, the University Council, an Academic Governance Steering Committee. Can you walk us through the process?
Sure. It's a kind of a complex one, as you just mentioned, but basically there are a couple different academic governance committees that run the academic affairs of the university when it comes to faculty. The one of them, the University Council, met the other day, and they asked for a faculty vote on no confidence. What was determined is that they would send out a ballot to every member of the faculty, about 2,200 members of Michigan State's faculty, and ask them if they wanted a vote on this. If it happens, if enough people say yes, then it will go to the Faculty Senate, which is a smaller body made up of elected representatives from each of the various colleges that make up Michigan State. Those folks then would vote whether or not the faculty still have confidence in Luana Simon to continue as president of the university.
So they go to the whole faculty body to see if there should be a vote, and then the Faculty Senate actually makes the vote.
Yep, that's right. And those faculty senators are elected by the members of the various colleges. So just like in Congress, right, they represent different folks there.
How soon could a vote be taken?
The meeting could be scheduled for as soon as next week. They expect all the process to be done. The emails going out to all the faculty should be going out today. They're going to tabulate them all and see if they want to go. And then they'll gather probably this weekend to figure out when that meeting would be set. But I would expect them to go quickly.
Okay, so how much weight would a vote of no confidence have on the Board of Trustees or the president?
So these are generally symbolic votes. They carry no real no real consequences. But I think if you got a huge amount, if you got some wide percentage, you know, of faculty, the folks that, you know, do the work of the university, which is there to educate students, the people who do that work, if 75, 80, 85% of those folks said, we don't trust STAR or LEADER anymore, that's really got to start playing into the minds of these board members who are under tremendous pressure already to get rid of President Simon.
In the meantime, you report that part of the trustees meeting a few days ago was spent discussing what a succession plan would look like, even though the majority of the board says she's not going anywhere. What's that tell you?
It tells me that they are starting to feel that change is on the way.
There's pressure there that they can't deny.
Right. I mean, when you start having, you know, everyone from the student body government, you know, voting unanimously, by the way, those are the customers of the university, so to speak, saying we want new leadership, you know, and then you start getting into all the politicians that have weighed in, the folks that control the funds that go to them from the state of Michigan.
Certain newspaper editorial boards.
Newspaper editorial boards all across the state, all across the nation. The amount of pressure that's being added to these board members daily, you know, is just is amazing.
David Jesse is a reporter with the Detroit Free Press. Hey, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Hey, no problem. Thanks.
Still to come, a new biography about Michigan Senator Arthur Vandenberg.
If you're not president, unless you're some kind of notorious character, you tend to slip between the cracks of political history.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Well, it's Wednesday. Let's look at a bit of Michigan's history.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
In the early days of making cars, many companies quickly appeared and then disappeared nearly as fast. In an article in Michigan History magazine, Steve Ostrander noted there were 34 automakers in the 1920s. One of them was named after a World War I flying ace, and Steve Ostrander joins us now. I take it this car company not only was named after this war hero, but he was part of the company.
He was. They did, you know, set out to trade on his name. When he came back from the war, we're talking about World War I now, he was, you know, the most decorated Allied pilot. And, you know, he was very famous, almost like Lindbergh after him. He was very famous, and so they wanted to cash in on that notoriety. But Eddie Rickenbacker was a principled man, and he said, well, if I'm going to be involved in this car company, I do want to be involved. So they made him marketing director and a vice president of the company.
Well, that makes sense with all that fame. How did he get involved in building cars? Why was that an interest?
Eddie Rickenbacker actually had been interested in racing cars before he joined the Army. He actually was interested at a very young age. He worked after school. He worked nights in a machine shop, and he took a correspondence course in mechanical engineering. So he left school, actually, I think he left when he was about 14, and went to work for a company that was developing and actually racing cars, and he ended up becoming a race car driver too in his late teens. So he was very interested in automobiles, so it was kind of a natural thing for him.
You write the sales were strong within the first couple of years. What kind of success did they have?
By 1923, they had sold about 6,000 automobiles, but things started to go downhill and sales tapered off, and it wasn't as successful as they had hoped it would be.
Part of the problem was that Rickenbacker came up with an innovation that car manufacturers all use today, but it ended up destroying the Rickenbacker car company. What was that innovation?
That was four-wheel brakes. Up until then, most cars only had brakes on the rear. So Rickenbacker decided, well, four-wheel brakes is the way to go. After all, he was a race car driver. He knew about these things. So the company decided to go this way, and they even went so far as to stencil on the spare tire canvas cover on the back of the car, four-wheel brakes. But other companies tried to sort of run a smear campaign against them, saying that four-wheel brakes are dangerous. The car will stop too fast. People behind them will run into them. There'll be all these rear-end collisions. And the only reason they put four-wheel brakes on the spare tire cover is to warn people that this is a Rickenbacker, so you better be careful. They might stop too fast.
That's just amazing. And I guess Studebaker was one of the leading companies that were not kind to Rickenbacker.
Studebaker was probably the worst offender, but a lot of the other ones, they sort of jumped on that bandwagon too. There was a lot of competition at this time. 34 car makers all vying for, you know, the public to buy their cars. And the other thing that happened too was that one of the principals in the company died, ironically, in a car accident, and that really set back the company. It kind of put them into a tailspin.
What became of Eddie Rickenbacker after his days as an auto manufacturer?
Well, he actually left the company. He resigned because he sort of saw the handwriting on the wall. Unfortunately, he was left in debt. He was in debt to the tune of about $250,000, which was a lot of money in those days. But he vowed that he would pay off his creditors. Under the terms of the bankruptcy of the company, he didn't actually have to do that, but he said, no, I'm going to pay off these people that trusted me. And he did that. One of the things that he did after he left the company is he bought Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He was the chairman of the board for many, many years. And he also became chairman of the board of Eastern Airlines because of his interest in flying.
Steve Ostrander is with the Michigan History Center. We've been talking about the Rickenbacker Automobile Company, which started out with a strong line of vehicles only to end because of being, well, slandered by the competition. Steve, thanks very much.
Thank you.
When was the last time you heard about a politician who realized he needed to change to help the country, that former ways had to be put aside to foster bipartisan cooperation for the good of the country? Well, you're about to hear about one, a U.S. senator from Michigan, Arthur Vandenberg. There's a new biography out about him. Its author is Hank Meyer, and he joins us now. The subtitle of your book is The Man in the Middle of the American Century. In what way was Arthur Vandenberg in the middle of the American century?
Well, Lester, he really symbolized in many ways the changing role of the United States in the world. He had gone from being an isolationist before World War II and coming out of World War I saying, we've got to stay out of other people's wars and let's not put our boys in harm's way in Europe. Let's be neutral when these new wars were going to break out. And this is at a time when Hitler was coming to power and Mussolini and the Japanese are invading Manchuria. And then after the war, he came to recognize that America was the global undisputed superpower, that we had responsibilities to lead in the world, and that it was both in our interests and in the interest of world peace for the U.S. to take a leading role in forming the United Nations and in helping rebuild Europe through the Marshall Plan, things like that.
I want to talk further about how he got there, but let's start first with where he grew up. Grand Rapids, early childhood, pretty comfortable, but then the economy went bust and the family business went with it. What effect did that have on a young Vandenberg?
This is a young man who, at the age of 9, started helping support his family. He started a little delivery service between a shoe factory in downtown Grand Rapids and the railroad depot. And his father had a harness business, as you say, had been fairly prosperous. And then in the panic of 1893, an early depression, lost most of that business. So Arthur felt a real sense of responsibility, and he was a real go-getter. And so he was working all through school. He spent a year at the University of Michigan, then got a job as a reporter at the Grand Rapids Herald.
Right, and he quickly found himself leading the Grand Rapids Herald fairly shortly after he was there. I mean, a few years I'm speaking about. It was a Republican newspaper. What was it about him that led to such success so early in life?
This was a time when newspapers were, I don't want to say the only source of news, but certainly the most important. And his was the Republican newspaper. Most papers were also partisan at the time in this rapidly growing city. And he was a young orator. He was a pretty good writer. And he became editor at 22. And he's writing editorials every day for the newspaper, sending them off to Republican leaders in Washington. And so 10 years later, at the end of World War I, he's influencing the League of Nations debate by supplying arguments to Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, who's fighting with Woodrow Wilson over the covenant of the League of Nations.
He was involved fairly deeply in Michigan politics, too, and finally was appointed to fill a vacancy in the U.S. Senate. How did he first make his mark in the Senate?
He first came there in a way characteristic of his entire career, trying to build bridges. He came in just as Herbert Hoover became president in 1928, and Hoover was a brilliant engineer and administrator, but with no political experience. And the Republican Party, split as it often is, was split in those days between what was called the Old Guard, which was sort of the Eastern establishment, but very conservative, and the progressives, who tended to be Western politicians. And he came in trying to get them to work together with the president. They were both suspicious of Hoover. And so he went in trying to build bridges, but also first established his name with the early days of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. So the Depression comes in 1929, and in 1932 and 33, the economy is bottoming out. And in Detroit, in the first major city in the country, there was a banking crisis. The holding companies that owned the banks in Detroit were on the verge of collapse. And as a senator from Michigan, Vandenberg was trying to figure out how to rescue them and how to protect Michigan citizens and their savings deposits. And so he's negotiating the idea of deposit insurance, what became the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC. He brings that idea to Herbert Hoover and his Secretary of the Treasury. They don't want to have anything to do with it. This looks like a government bailout of the banks. And Vandenberg is saying, you know what, the only way we can restore confidence in our economy and in our banking system is if small depositors know that they can get their money out once they put it in. So then Franklin Roosevelt comes in. He goes to Roosevelt. He's been governor of New York, certainly no friend of Wall Street, but buying into the argument that strong banks shouldn't be trying to prop up weak ones. And so he doesn't want to have anything to do with deposit insurance. But Vandenberg lines up the votes in the Senate in a bipartisan way, and the FDIC is created. Turns out it's one of the most successful programs of the Depression, of the New Deal. Roosevelt later takes credit for it, but it was Arthur Vandenberg's baby.
Like any good writer, you found small stories that told big things about Vandenberg. There was a moment in the book that really struck me. It's 1932, depths of the Depression. A Michigan fruit grower named Adolf Belter came to Senator Vandenberg. His house had burned, and he brought in some charred rolls of money that he'd had stashed in a mason jar, presumably because no one trusted the banks at the time. The money was ruined. But Mr. Belter was hoping that Senator Vandenberg could somehow do something, anything for him. Tell us what happened.
Well, constituent service is an important part of a politician's job. And so he marched over to the Treasury Department with Adolf Belter, and they went to the people who work with the mint, and they have scientists who try to determine the origins of currency. And they were able to look at the charred remains of the farmers' dollar bills and figure out the denominations and were able to issue currency to help him. But you're right, that symbolized a time when people no longer trusted the banks. And so they're putting their money in mason jars, they're putting their money under the mattress, and there was no way the economy was going to get started again if that's what we felt we had to do to protect ourselves.
So as you mentioned, he didn't really like President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. He was an isolationist and against getting into another war in Europe. But this staunch Republican learned to work with Democrats to get things done during the biggest trial this nation has faced in its years. What's the lesson there for today's politicians?
He really viewed compromise not as something bad, but almost as an art form, as the way our democracy is supposed to work. Now, he learned that lesson painfully because Roosevelt was swept into office to fight the Depression, and the Republicans were tarred by the disaster of the Depression. And so by 1934, after that midterm election, there were only 17 Republicans in the Senate. So if you wanted to get anything done, whether it was deposit insurance or stopping some extravagant spending plan of the president's, and he was a good conservative, you had to work across the aisle. So he honed those skills out of necessity. But then when the big stuff came after World War II, and these were momentous decisions, do we join a United Nations? Do we commit ourselves to this massive aid program to rebuild the European democracies? Do we enter into an entangling alliance, which Vandenberg had always been loath to do because he was a follower of Alexander Hamilton, who advised George Washington not to do that, and then which became NATO? Those are things that shouldn't be done by one party. Those are committing the American people to major undertakings and sometimes sacrifices, and we've all got to do it together. And so he recognized that, and that really motivated him to reach across the aisle.
Vandenberg was well known in his time. He was mentioned in the same breath with names like Churchill and Roosevelt. He was well thought of. He was begrudgingly respected by his opponents, mentioned as a possible president in the future. Edward R. Murrow called him the central pivot of the entire era. How is it we don't know him better?
It's funny how some people can slip through the cracks of history. He was an editorial writer himself, had written short stories, had always wanted to write his own memoirs, but died of cancer while still in office and was unable to do that. He had two other would-be biographers. One was a reporter for the rival Grand Rapids Press who kept voluminous scrapbooks, was a Vandenberg contemporary, but didn't live to write anything. And then another biographer who had turned his dissertation at University of Michigan back in 1970 into the first of two volumes of Vandenberg, died before he could write the second volume. And the second volume really covers the most important years of Vandenberg's life. And so if you don't live to write the history and somebody else writes it from their point of view, it's awfully easy to be forgotten. And we tend to look at history in our modern age through presidential eras. And so if you're not president, unless you're some kind of notorious character, you tend to slip between the cracks of political history.
You mentioned FDIC, you mentioned NATO. What do you think his lasting legacies, his accomplishments that affect our lives are today?
Unquestionably, he was indispensable in helping with the Marshall Plan. When Europe was devastated after the war and the most powerful military force in Europe was the Red Army, who now had swallowed up Poland and some of the other Eastern European countries, and Britain, France, the Netherlands, all these countries, their economies are crushed. President Truman had the good sense, knowing that we had to help them, to call his proposal the Marshall Plan, because General Marshall was revered and nonpartisan. Marshall said it could have been called the Vandenberg Plan, because Vandenberg really put it through. And that resurrected Western civilization to some extent, or was awfully important. And then on the heels of that came the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, that said, you know, we democracies have shared values, and we really need to be mutually assisting one another to protect ourselves, in this case, from the communist threat that had replaced the Nazi threat after World War II. Those are his big pieces of legislation. But more than that, I think, is the spirit of compromise that said, I am going to find a middle ground because that's where the interests of the American people ultimately lie. And he became a symbol so that now every time there is a foreign policy crisis of some kind and you have one party in the White House and the other party in Congress, somebody said, well, where is there a Vandenberg now? And so I think that symbol of how we want our government to work may be his most lasting legacy.
You've got a day job. Your time is in demand. You spent all this time writing this biography of Arthur Vandenberg. What was it that caught your attention that you wanted to commit yourself to that?
He was a local guy, and I had been in the newspaper business as well. I'd gone to the University of Michigan as well. I graduated from public high school in Grand Rapids as well, so I always felt a little commonality there and have always loved foreign policy and international politics. But beyond that, I got to have this sense of mission, that this was an important story that hadn't been told. And you could walk down the street 20 years ago in Grand Rapids and say, who was Arthur Vandenberg? And literally people would say, well, was he related to the jewelry store? Because there used to be a jewelry store of that name. No, he wasn't. But he, you know, he did some other things. There was a young man named Gerald Ford who got his start in politics with the endorsement of Arthur Vandenberg. And so he was this really major figure who was forgotten to a large degree in his own hometown and in his own home state, even as he was a major figure at a crucial time in our history on the world stage.
Hank Meyer is the author of the book Arthur Vandenberg, The Man in the Middle of the American Century. Mr. Meyer's day job is executive chairman of Meyer Incorporated. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
It's a pleasure, Lester. Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up in 10 minutes, we'll look at school choice in Michigan. You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder outlined his plans for the state during his last year in office, and joining me to talk about the governor's State of the State address is the It's Just Politics crew, Michigan Radio Capital Bureau Chief Rick Pluta, and our resident political junkie Zoe Clark. So first off, hi guys.
Hello.
Hey, you.
The governor says the state has come back. Detroit has come back. More people are moving in for the first time in a long time. Unemployment is way down. Lots of jobs created. The governor ticked off a lot of things. Does he actually get to claim credit for everything?
Well, yeah, because he's the governor. So, yes, you know, when times are good, governors get more credit than they deserve. And when times are bad, then governors get, you know, more blame than they deserve.
And just as well, you know, the Democratic response, they get to claim, well, they're not good enough jobs. Well, the folks in Flint surely don't feel like there's a comeback. And those in the neighborhoods of Detroit who aren't in downtown and seeing the Gilbert and Illich growth would say no. So, of course, it's every perspective has its own about whether or not things are good or bad. But there are some significant numbers that this governor pulled out. In fact, about 5 minutes before the speech, media was handed folders that had these kind of printouts, and they were handing them out that had, you know, these big, you know, this many jobs and things like this, which I think just is, again, such an indication
growth,
of how this governor
like that, yeah.
looks at things.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the Democratic response, actually, a lot of what we heard is Democrats saying, we like what we heard.
Right.
We just don't trust that when it comes time to start bargaining these things, that we're going to have a seat at the table and that we're going to get some of the things that we want.
Which for these, you know, Democratic responses now, this is the final and eighth, as you know, we've talked about Snyder response. We have heard now, you know, eight Democratic responses, and Democrats have been in the minority. That is why they have done the response to the speech, and it's sort of the same. But, you know, they don't have a lot of leverage when you have a supermajority Republican in the Senate and Republicans in the House.
A decisive majority in the House, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, let's hear a couple of things that the governor talked about. First of all, he wants to increase the money for schools, and here he is talking about that.
When I do the budget coming up in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I'm going to be proposing the largest increase in the basic per pupil student foundation allowance in the last 15 years. Let's invest more in education and the operations of our schools.
Is the legislature going to be spending more for schools?
Yes. The question is, will the legislature spend as much as Rick Snyder wants for schools in the face of other Republican priorities? You know, writ large, you know, the state of the state, that's the governor's moment to say, here's what should happen in the coming year. And then after that, everything comes down to the nitty-gritty of bargaining with people who very often don't agree with you.
And of course, Lester, I mean, so this is sort of the big, bold, you know, official state of the state. It happens in the Capitol. There's the pomp and the circumstance, you know, Michigan radio and TV and radio from across the state do big coverage of it. But really what we'll be watching in terms of those actual numbers of dollars being spent on all of this is February 7th. And that is when this governor will release the, you know, executive budget recommendation, what they would like to see for numbers. And that's when we'll really dig in and be able to kind of, you know, see how many digits on each of this and what they're proposing when it comes to actual dollars.
Yeah. Sometimes the budget rollout is referred to as the second state of the state because that's when you put numbers to priorities.
Well, we know he's planning on increasing money for roads beyond what the legislature passed in its 2015 package. How much is more?
Mm-hmm. Well, we will see. And it was kind of interesting because that was, you know, one of just a few markers that the governor threw down on the legislature where he kind of went, you know, where we've gone in the past hasn't been good enough, that the legislature didn't give him as much for roads as he wanted the last time around. And this was him saying, you know what, we're not done with that conversation.
I think the phrase always is, we can do better.
Right. And for Rick Snyder, roads, infrastructure has so much been a part of the conversation, I would say almost up until the Flint water crisis, when that story took over everything for good measure. But I mean, let's remember for years in the first term of this governor's administration, it was always talking about his number, which is that we needed more than $1 billion a year for roads. And, you know, mm-hmm. this latest package was nowhere close to that. So it will be interesting to see what number he says he wants. Is it close to the more than, you know, $1 billion that he had asked for years ago? And at this point, how much can he do in the last year, less than a year? And mm-hmm. and I can tell you, I don't think it's going to be putting $1 billion in roads this year.
And not just roads, that he was talking about other types of infrastructure.
All of this money we're talking about, Speaker of the House Tom Leonard indicates he's got other plans rather than spending money on roads and schools.
It's now time to allow the taxpayers to appreciate that or see more money in their pockets.
So can the governor, no matter what he proposes in the budget, get anything past the legislature that's looking for a way to cut taxes?
Well, actually, and what Tom Leonard was talking about is just a classic example of what we're talking about here, which is not just, you know, tax cuts and tax cuts that are bigger than what the governor has proposed, but Tom Leonard also wants to deal with driver responsibility fees. That money would have to come from somewhere else in the state budget. And the governor says that he wants money for infrastructure, for roads, as we talked about, but other types of infrastructure, invasive species, environmental cleanups, more money for schools. All of those are going to cost money that's not in the budget right now. And I think it's probably going to cost more than any growth that we can expect to see in revenues.
The first year that this governor delivered his State of the State address, Rick and I were covering it. And at the end of the speech, Rick turned around and said, well, do we need a Republican response to this, Republican governor's State of the State address? And hearing some of this speech reminded me a little bit of that.
I flashed back on that, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Next week, the governor says he's going to be introducing several initiatives, and here he is talking about that.
Back to infrastructure again. We need to do more in the future. We've done a lot, but we can't stop, particularly our environment. So on Monday through Friday of next week, each and every day, I'm going to roll out a new major initiative on the environment or infrastructure. And to give you the list of what those topics are, I'm not going to spend a lot of time tonight, but I want you to know we're putting markers out there to say we need to invest more.
Now, I don't recall the governor previously spending a lot of time talking about environmental issues. Why the greater interest in the environment at the end of his time as governor?
Because this is something that's been under discussion behind closed doors for years now, that the money that the state raised through the sale of environmental cleanup bonds has run out, even though we are still paying for those bonds. And the cleanups still need to happen. That job is undone. And so the question is, where do you come up with the money for those environmental, this new round of environmental cleanups? And they've never been able to resolve it. And I think what we're hearing here is the governor saying that, look, I'm only here for a few more months, and this is all stuff that's got to be wrapped up before I walk out the door.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing to note because we haven't always had an environmental first policy out of Lansing over the past 8 years. But I would remind all of us that when this governor was first running, almost 8 years ago, that the League of Conservation Voters actually endorsed Snyder. And it was one of the first, you know, Republicans that they had endorsed in a very, very long time. I believe that for some of them came to maybe regret that decision or feel like they had put too much hope in a Republican and to see some of the environmental policies. But again, this is all coming back kind of full circle to initially what this governor wanted to spend money on: infrastructure, the environment.
Recycling.
That is Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, our It's Just Politics team. You can catch that segment on Michigan Radio on Mondays or look for it at michiganradio.org. Thank you both.
Thanks, you Lester. Bet.
This is National School Choice Week, so let's take a look at school choice in Michigan. Joining us is Gary Miron. He's a professor at Western Michigan University, and he evaluates school choice policies. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what grade would you give Michigan's approach to implementing school choice?
For evaluating school choice based on outcomes, I would give it, unfortunately, a failing grade.
Ooh. Why?
Because if I look at the original policy intent of legislation for school choice, it hasn't achieved those outcomes.
We'll talk more about that in detail, but I want to ask you a couple of things that are happening right now. Legislation is working its way through Lansing, which would allow tax dollars, local millage dollars, to go to charter schools. What do you think of that proposal?
Well, I think school funding is very complicated, but when we look at charter schools often have cost advantages. They receive less money per pupil, but because they have different types of students and they have fewer programs, they end up having fewer dollars per pupil, but still having cost advantages. And I can go into greater detail why that happens, but they are funded under a fair formula right now, but it doesn't mean that they have equal amounts of money coming to them.
Part of school choice is virtual schools. Kids stay at home. I've got one at my house. They take online lessons and homework, which I guess all of their homework is literally homework. How well are virtual schools working in Michigan?
Universally, they're failing. Today, we have 37 virtual schools in Michigan serving more than 7,000 students. And across the board, we're seeing at all outcomes, whether school performance measures, such as student attrition is very high. We're seeing their performance in terms of state ratings. They're universally receiving unacceptable ratings from the state education agency. And it's not only in Michigan. We're seeing this in other states. And I have to point out, it's not only the virtual charter schools. Even districts are opening virtual schools, and their overall performance is also very poor.
And they get the same amount of dollars for this service, so it's an advantage to a district or a charter school, right?
They're funded under the similar funding formula. But if they don't offer special ed students, they don't get a lot of categorical funding. They wouldn't get that extra funding. If they don't have a vocational ed program, they wouldn't be able to tap into some additional funds and so forth. So they're funded under a similar formula, a fair formula, the same formula, but it doesn't mean they get equal amounts of money.
Gotcha. In recent years, in some cases around the state, school choice has been used by white parents to move their kids from school districts with a growing population of people of color to a charter school or a nearby school district with more white kids. How much does school choice contribute to segregation in this state?
We studied this in great detail nationally in 2010, and there was a concern prior to school choice, including charter school reforms, that this would be a vehicle for white flight, as some call it. And we found the evidence is there. It supports that. But what was equally surprising was that minority flight is just as great. So we see here in Michigan, we see students in somewhat diverse urban schools, such as in the Detroit area, where there may be between 60 and 70% minority students, and students leaving those schools to go to schools where there's 95 or higher in terms of percentage of minority students. So they're going to Afrocentric school, they're going to Latino schools. So segregation by race is happening in both directions, self-segregation by different populations. And it's also fueled also by the way that schools market themselves.
Let's go back to your failing grade for how Michigan does school choice. You're a supporter of charter schools and school choice, but you think Michigan's not doing a good job, obviously. How can Michigan do school choice right?
So school choice is a policy tool. It can be a tool that policymakers can use to pursue different outcomes that we want. School choice can be designed to reduce segregation and isolation in our schools. It can be used as a vehicle for, you know, supporting innovation and other things. Unfortunately, in our state, this potential tool is just used as a policy, as an ends in itself. Just the fact that we've opened up choices seems to satisfy policymakers, and that seems to be one of their pursuits, is just to provide school choice as an outcome, not seeing the potential of designing these reforms to pursue particular outcomes.
Are there states with good policies that Michigan could use as a model?
Yes, there are. And we see when we use school choice, it can be used, there's kind of two big schools of thought. One is we bring in school choice and we have this competitive effect. We get as many, you know, schools open as possible. We draw as many students away from the public schools as possible to make the public schools hurt. And through that competitive effect, then they'll wake up and they're going to respond and they're going to improve. That's the Michigan school of thought. And we see some states, especially some smaller states like Connecticut and Delaware, where I've also served as a state evaluator, those states tend to have a different model where they're going to do smaller numbers of choice or charter schools, and they provide them the supports and they're selective on who gets to operate the schools. And they focus on improving public schools by example through. So they focus on higher quality schools, they close the low performing schools, and they try to share those innovations and ideas. So it's not that competitive effect, but also that sharing of ideas. When we look at states, they break into one or the other. The competitive effect model, that's typically what we see in states where there's more partisan legislation. And when we see bipartisan legislation, we see smaller school choice reforms focused on quality.
We've seen Michigan go down in its quality after taking standardized tests. We know that it used to rank much higher among the other states than it does today. Why isn't that a sign for policymakers that something's going wrong?
There's many factors. One is definitely school choice, that we've done it so aggressively and so widespread has devastated our traditional public schools. But there's a number of factors behind that. Michigan is also losing, or over the last decade, it's been a net loser of students in our country. And over the next 10 years, we're projected to lose even more students in our overall school system. And so what we're seeing in our urban schools, we're seeing slowly the numbers of students going down. So when there's competition, it's really hard on those schools who end up having empty seats and half-empty schools. Our suburban Detroit schools are doing better because they can still fill their places through the Schools of Choice program, pulling students out of the urban areas. But our urban schools are suffering. First, they're losing students. Second, they have fewer teachers left, and those teachers have to carry that burden of the pension, state pension system. More and more of our teachers are now private employees through the privatized charter schools. So we have these big burdens, and then we have this big infrastructure of our urban schools. And again, fewer and fewer students left to support that infrastructure. And, you know, we can just look at that burden on the pensions, the long-term debt that was incurred to support these large school systems. And then we have to look at the fact that we're losing students. And in our urban schools, as numbers go down each year, the concentrations of children in poverty go up. The concentration of children with disabilities goes up in those urban schools because of choice programs. Those urban schools will end up with the students who are most costly to educate.
So we've got a minute left. Can you tell me what the state's policymakers' top priority should be to fix this?
They need to look at school choice as a policy tool, as a tool that we can design to pursue the publicly established outcomes that we desire as a society. Right now, the two things that school choice are achieving in our state, they're accelerating segregation by race, by class, by special education status, and by language of instruction. They're also being used as a vehicle for privatization. These are things that weren't articulated in the policy intent, but we have to look at those. Those are the objectives that are being served right now, and we need to realign that and redesign school choice to serve the public good.
Gary Miron is a professor at Western Michigan University's Department of Educational Leadership, Research, and Technology. Thanks for talking with us about school choice.
Thank you very much.
Tune in to Stateside tomorrow when we'll discuss Michigan's 911 system. Have you called 911 recently? Did everything go okay, or were there issues? Leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. We just might play it on the air. Or go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org and share your story there. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I want to say thanks to the Michigan radio staff who caught and relocated the second squirrel which got into the radio station this week. It was like watching the Keystone Cops. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Candy. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.